and welcome to the ETPHD Team Podcast, episode number 24.5. The next episode of questions with myself, Louie and Anna. Hi, Louie.
Hello, how are you?
Delightful, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good, how are you, Anna?
Yeah, good, thank you. Oh, good.
Do you know what we do? We have this conversation before we actually go on the podcast, and the answers to this are far less enthusiastic of the podcast. And then we come on the podcast and we've vented it all out, and so now we're all great.
Absolutely.
We're all fine.
We are all absolutely fine. Has anyone got any really exciting news from the week?
I was trying to think. We're back in the gym. That's about all that's changed for me and Louis. So.
Oh, yeah. Sorry to your three friends.
I haven't even gone back to the gym. I haven't even gone back, so I'm still in lockdown technically.
Are you going back, or are you just enjoying time out for a bit more?
I think my hunger to go back is more than it was before. After the first lockdown, I was a bit like, I quite got into running, but I think I went so far into running that I didn't do any strength training really. And like, I've noticed a difference in like just my DOMS and just feeling a bit weaker in general. So I'll probably go back, but it'll be a handful of times a week maximum, and then just carry on running, I think.
Yeah. I was saying to my friend the other day, I don't understand how I have time to go to the gym all the time. Like, we went for a walk and I was like, what? How am I going to fit the gym in? Because when I've been training at home, it's like half an hour of yoga, or, you know, a half an hour circuit at home, and that's it, three times a week. And I'm like, oh, when I go to the gym, I have to get dressed, and then it takes me like an hour to train, and then I don't know how I'm going to have time. So I think I'm the same as you. I think my actual volume is probably going to take a bit of a nosedive. But I also don't want to give up yoga. So obsessed. Honestly, I've become that person. I mean, I'm not that person clearly, because I still can't do it, but I have a dream of being the person that is good at yoga. Like, that, like, that's a goal.
So good. Even if you are rubbish at it, doesn't it?
It's so good.
Zone, you are zen. It's
yeah, but do you know what, like, when I used to do it, I didn't feel zen. I just was angry all the way through. I was just like, so crap at this, I can't do it, and I would be looking at the clock, and I hated it. But when doing it at home, and I only do half an hour sessions, and I put the fire on and I'm warm and I'm not that bad anymore, I'm like, actually, this is quite nice. This is what Anna was talking about for the last 12 months of my life. Finally, I've got there. And I also feel like I want a yoga identity. Like, I feel like
it's just like the cherry on top for you.
Yeah, that's what I feel like. And so I want to be like, tick that box, because I feel like I'm lacking, you know, this egoic side of me needs to be a yogi and wear Lululemons and do all those things. But yeah, Anna, well, you've got the gym. I don't think anything exciting to me has happened this week, other than my computer broke, which is just, you know, it's just 2020, let's be honest. However, they said they're going to do it for free, so that's good. So technically, it wasn't even my fault that it broke. So, you know, could be worse.
2020 is like just a phrase now, and that's going to stick around for generations. It was like, oh, so 2020 today.
Yeah. I was thinking, you know, obviously now we're in December, and it's like, oh, because Christmas. And I'm just like, nah, 2020, just nah, sod it. Just is.
Yeah, 2020s. What's is it a verb, a doing word? I'm not very good on my English grammar, but it's going to become like, you know how we say, oh, I'll just Google things, and it's just like like 2020 is going to be like that. It's like, how are you? Good? Nah, I'm 2020, mate. Oh, we know what that means. Okay, questions. We have got plenty again. So, Louis, do you want to go first?
Yes. So. A nice one to start off, and it was around bedtime routines. Any suggestions of what to do, what to implement? This client is struggling to sort of switch off a little bit, or they might notice that they want to try and improve their sleep, and through that improve like their getting up in the morning, feeling a bit more refreshed. So, Anna, do you have any suggestions?
Well, coincidentally, I've been struggling to sleep this week. So, things I've done this week that I think kind of probably slipped a little bit in the last couple of weeks. Phone off like hour or so before bed. Either journal or meditate for me, just to get everything off up my mind for the day. And when I've really been struggling to fall asleep, some sleep-specific meditation. Or just on Spotify, they've got some quite nice, like, sleep music. I don't know what it was, but that was quite nice. It did the job. So, yeah.
Yeah, I can't sleep now without meditating before bed. Like, I go on holiday, and when I go on holiday, I usually go with my best mate, and she has to listen to it. She quite likes it, I think, before we go to bed, because it's so drilled into my sleep routine now that I lie in bed like wide awake if I've not got Shannon Algio or someone else on unplug on in my ears. I'd also say, like, on the topic of meditation even earlier in the day actually is shown to improve sleep quality and quantity. So even if you're not doing it before bed, actually meditating at some point in the day is really helpful. Getting daylight earlier in the day is helpful, so about half an hour of daylight. I know it's tough right now, but that's really helpful for your sleep. Make sure you're having caffeine no later than 8 to 10 hours before bed. I know it seems like a long time, but it's really helpful. Same with Anna, like turning off, I turn off social media 100% by like 9 p.m, an hour before bed at least. But also doing things like putting your phone in blue light mode. I do that at dinner time. So you should be putting your phone in blue light mode like when it gets dark, basically. And if you use a computer, do the same. So your computer should have a blue light setting. If you don't, then get some cheap blue light blockers. They're really helpful because even your TV probably doesn't have that. So it's useful to have them for TV. I mean, I don't do it for TV, but I usually use it for podcasts and stuff. So that can be helpful. And I think that might be all I've got. Louis, have you got any more?
No, just I find a huge difference with my blue light blockers in the evenings, and also like dimming lights and stuff like that a bit earlier in the evening, that can sort of like chill you out a little bit more. I for years have struggled just to go to like sleep without anything like playing, as in like in the background. So I have like rain music before I go to bed and fall asleep to that, and I find that sort of like soothes me, but also like helps distract me a little bit, and then I sort of drift off. Getting the room as dark as possible when you're going to bed as well, that could be another thing as well. And just getting into a routine of going to bed at a similar time, getting up at a similar time, can be really helpful as well.
Yeah. Also a cold room is better for sleep quality as well. So keep your windows open in your room and shut your door. That can be really helpful because your body gets into deep sleep at a certain body temperature. So you want it to be a nice, cool room as well. And like Louis said, yeah, that regularity is very important also, if you can. Mm-hmm. Cool. Anna, have you got a question?
Yes. Where are we? Okay, so eating on your own versus eating around people. I find eating with people quite stressful. Any advice on how to handle this or manage urges to sneak off and eat on my own?
Okay. I'll start, I think. You need to figure out, first of all, what it is that's causing you stress. Is it the commotion of just things going on around you, or is it the perceived judgment of the things, people around you? It's not the situation that's causing you stress. And this is similar to something we spoke about last week, I think. It's not the situation that's causing you stress. It's your thoughts about that situation that's causing you stress. So, for example, are you stressed because you think that that person is judging you for how you're eating? Or are you, like, do you find it uncomfortable because you think that person wants you to eat more, or you're trying to be polite for someone else? Or is it actually because that there are people around you that are vocalizing something that makes you feel uncomfortable? If it's the latter and people are actually vocalizing something, then it's time to put a strategy in place and a boundary in place that allows you to manage that. So that boundary might be, you know, if someone comments on what I'm eating, I'm going to say this, and you're going to have that in your kind of bank, so that when it does come up, you've got that ready to say that. If it's not that anyone's saying anything and it's the thoughts that's in your head, think of what it is you're thinking. So it's they're judging me, you know, X, Y, and Z. And then ask yourself, I heard this on a podcast recently, then ask yourself, so what? So say you think to your head, in your head, those people are judging me, they think that I should eat more, they think that I should eat less, X, Y, and Z. So what? What does that mean to you? That makes me feel like I am fat, or that makes me feel ashamed, or that makes me feel like I am not enough, or whatever it is. And then work on that. Ultimately, you know, you're not going to be able to live a life where you're never eating around other people. So you need to figure out what it is that's triggering you, what thoughts it's triggering in you, and what that means on a sort of bigger level. So what that people think that you should eat more, and what. So I think really doing that work on yourself is really important. And if it's the distraction things, then focus on being more mindful. So putting your cutlery down between bites, having conversation when you're not got a mouth full. So when you're actually discussing things, put your fork and knife and fork down, and have it talk, and then eat again. Notice taste, textures, all the things that we talk about when you're being mindful. Do all those things as well at the same time. Louis, do you have anything to add on that?
No, I was just going to add on the point of I find it really beneficial having social meals when you want to have a mindful meal, because you can actually discuss the textures and tastes and explore together, because people often have different perceptions around food. So that can be actually a really nice experience, especially if someone's put a lot of time into matching and pairing all these different flavors, textures, and enjoying the other aspects as well. So actually time to catch up with the family, time spent as a family potentially, or with your significant other, and having those conversations. There's lots of benefits to having that social aspect as well. So actually looking at what can I gain from this situation, and instead of taking that pressure off, the stress or the pressure that you feel about it, actually going, well, what am I looking forward to at this meal, and what can I gain from it, is a good way to reframe it as well.
I like that. Excuse me while I open my 10-year-old iPad and my question. Okay, a completely different tangent. Mobility drills / workouts, are they actually physically beneficial? Does anybody want to jump in on that?
Who are you pointing at?
I was saying, you go ahead, Anna.
Yes, very, very useful. To prevent injury, increase range of movement when you are doing your training. I think at the minute, especially if anyone else is in a igloo of a gym, it's vital to do some kind of dynamic stretches as well, and really get the blood flowing. More so for injury prevention, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And also you get a bit of psychological preparation at the same time, and you get to wait a little bit longer before your caffeine kicks in. I think that side of things can be helpful. Oh my god, guys, total tangent. Louis, you didn't put your Spotify Wrapped on the Facebook group this week.
Oh, I'll do that, because I think it's a good one. I think there's some interesting ones in there.
Oh, I can't wait. It's like nobody really wants to know, but also we all really want to know this, because it really is. Dr. Mike, I saw him saying on his story today, like, this year Spotify Wrapped is the most authentic year, because you're listening to it on your own, right? You're always listening to it on your own. So whatever you're listening to is like, that's the true you. And I am one angry woman that really likes Alanis Morissette, apparently. That was off topic, but it just reminded me the psychological warm-up. Yes, mobility drills are beneficial. Like, nothing excessive, but yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's important to recognize that mobility versus flexibility is the difference, is having the control across that increased range of motion. And that can be having like stuff like getting deeper in a squat, and instead of having say going out to a bench press and you haven't got good shoulder mobility, then the strain's going on to tendons and ligaments when it goes down to the bottom potentially. So actually it's actually getting more benefit from the exercise as well. So you're stimulating more muscle, and actually your gains in strength and muscle mass over a longer period of time will be better as well.
Excellent. Okay. I'm going to go for another one if that's okay, because I've got about 20 here. Okay. how to prioritise self-care, in brackets, training, walks, meditation, etc., in a very busy work schedule? Louis, do you want to start on that?
Yeah, it's you can't be at your best for them if you're not giving yourself the best opportunity to be your best. So instead of working at a 60 or 70% capacity for longer hours, instead of just taking some time for yourself where you're totally away from it, means that you can give 100% when you're there and be totally present instead of thinking about how tired you are or you've got to do these other things that you've got in the background. It can give you that extra percent when you're there. I think we've got into a culture where it's working harder is working longer, is giving more time, when actually we can just be more efficient with that time as well. So prioritizing that time for you allows you to turn up and be fully present and be your best when you're there. Scheduling it in is so important. We've just spoke about like bedtime routines and switching off at a certain time for ourselves. We know that we could all be doing work until, if we wanted to, until 12 o'clock at night some nights, but actually prioritizing and going, I need to do this for me, so tomorrow they're getting the best version of me instead of me turning up knackered because I've had like 4 hours sleep, and then we're just going to go on a slow decline then, and that's where you start to get run down potentially in your training, you start to get injured and things like that. So allowing yourself to be the best that you can. I saw a quote and I think it was like, the task will take as long as the amount of time you give to it. And if you can, instead of saying, oh, I've got like 8 hours to kill today at work, going, right, so what am I doing for this time and this time and this time, and being more clinical with your hours in the day. I'm reading a great book at the moment, just to plug one, called How to Have a Good Day by Caroline Webb, and it is fantastic. So this helps with like structuring your day, and it's all about getting the most out of your day. So if you get on that, she's got some great TED talks and things as well that can help you structure, and talks about self-care and rest. We know with training, for an example, we need to have that stimulus, but then we also need to have our recovery time as well. If we're constantly stimulating, that's when we start to break down, break, and our training goes to pot. We don't actually get any progress. We need to go to that bit of discomfort and work, and then go back to a comfortable position where we're going to recharge to go again. So that's probably the attitude that I'd have with it.
Yeah, I have nothing to add. You covered that entirely.
Yeah, I don't have anything to add either. I think I have nothing to add either. All I can say is if I was writing someone's update at 7 p.m. on a Friday, I can tell you now that their feedback, they wouldn't be a client for very long, and their feedback would be crap, and they wouldn't make good progress because I've been acquired. Like, you, like, quality over quantity. Well, actually, you want quantity, but you want more quality. Yes. Who's next, Louis?
I think it's me. Let's go for how are the team approaching Christmas with their nutrition and training. So, Amelia.
Good question. Well, actually, so interestingly, so I was saying to you guys before we came on, I've got a holiday booked for the 28th of December for 2 weeks, and I was like, God, I've been really actively trying to gain weight the last couple of months, and I was like, oh, I must do a diet, and then I was like, oh, I don't really know what to do, it's Christmas, obviously I'm not dieting. I dieted for my last holiday, but as soon as I got home, I was like, all I want to do is gain weight again. So I'm not doing anything. Do you know what I'm doing, actually? I decided in December when I was thinking about my holiday is I've done, like, simple swaps for me, and it's not about fat loss, but I'm really trying to focus on health whilst I've got control over my health and my food choices. So for now, I'm like, I've swapped my nighttime chocolate for protein bars and things like that. So it's not about calorie swaps. It's about bringing in health. And I was like, no. But it's not excluding anything. It's just bringing in more vegetables. John, my handyman, dropped off some of his homegrown leeks for me the other day, and I'm just trying to get more nutrients in, because I know that, like, when I go back to Scotland, I'll be going back for a couple of weeks, I'll have less control over it, but my mum just eats fish and veg all the time, so like I'm always like, which is great, but I'm always like, oh, I need some more substance, so I'm trying to get as much of it in now as I can. But my nutrition, I'm genuinely being more mindful of the nutrients that I get in, and I've got an email on this for the email list for tomorrow, actually today, although it'll be today, because I know that, like, in the past I used to really, really struggle with Christmas, and I would be at uni and I'd starve myself up until Christmas pretty much. So I went because I always wanted to get home and be skinny with all my friends at home. And then I was so preoccupied with food, and I did the classic. I would just eat, do cardio in the morning, train at night, repeat over and over again, over cardio. And then when I got into competing, I remember when I was I would be in my off season at Christmas, and I would still do morning cardio, and I was much more blasé about it. I'm like, yeah, I'm just doing a little bit more cardio just to maintain my body comp, but it was still the same thing. It was just under the guise of something different. So now I'm like, I will do absolutely nothing different. I think we fall into this idea that Christmas food is different from any other food, but it's exactly the same as any other time of year. There's more of it around, but when the beauty of being able to eat mindfully is that there can be a box of mince pies on the counter, and actually you might eat one, you might not. Like, it doesn't impact anything about your internal self or your food choices or anything, like what's going on around you. What's that?
That's me being popular with a text message.
Right. I'm like, what's that sound? I've never heard that. Which says a lot about my social life. And my training's doing the same too. I'm just happy to be back in the gym. I'm literally not doing anything different. Are you guys? You? I don't know. Are you doing anything different?
No, I'm good with training. I'm excited to be back and maybe get a bit stronger again. But I think I'm quite happy, so I'm just going to keep going as I am. And actually, I wouldn't mind gaining a bit of weight, I think, at the minute. So if that happens, great. Let's hope it goes to my boobs, but I don't think it will.
See, I have been willing for that for the last 20 years, and it doesn't happen, to be honest. What about you, Louie? Are you willing for it to go to your boobs, or...?
I'd like a bit more muscle mass, ideally. I don't know if that happens like that as well. For me, it's like I've been spent a lot of time away from my family this year, as we all have, and I'm looking forward to spending a lot more time with my niece and nephew, and they're just like a little joy at this time of year, because they're like 1 and 2, or you might be 3 now, and they're just like little bits of joy, and Christmas is all around them, and that's what I'm looking forward to. I've sort of made it a tradition the last 2 years to go for a swim in the sea on Christmas Day. So I'm actually looking forward to that before. So I'm going to try and get up really early and go and do that. Start training, running and stuff. But like, I used to, probably like all of us, where there'd be a plan for Christmas where it'd be like, I'm dieting, I've got this goal. And 1 year when I was a rugby player, they made me go keto for Christmas because I was injured.
Oh my God.
Yeah, horrific. Like, and it was because the quote unquote nutritionist that we had in, doctor, was involved with like Britain's Biggest Loser at some point. I think he's like a Cambridge doctor, and he was pro keto. And like, as soon as I was injured, because I had AC joint, my shoulder went, they were like, it's a good time for you to strip down some fat. And I was like, but no, it's not. Like, this is probably not the good time. Now I'm saying that, but at the time it was like, they know what they're doing. So it was like going for fasted runs and going keto, like no carbs on Christmas Day. And I look back and I was like, what did I do that? Like, what did I gain that day? Nothing. I pretty much was just miserable, made meals really awkward because I was like, no, I'm not having any of that. And it was just, yeah, looking back on that. And then the last few years have been just a lot nicer with just, it's so family focused now with the little kids. So for me, it's just going to be spent more time with my mum and dad, niece, nephew, sister, brothers, and just knocking it down probably a few gears and like taking a bit of a relax and reflecting a little bit. That'll be my thing this Christmas.
I like that. I think people think, like, I understand it. People think that nutrition and training has to change over Christmas. And it's like, nothing has to change at all. Like, nothing at all has to change. If you're dieting, yeah, you might want to come back up to maintenance or loosen it off for a couple of weeks or potentially the month. It's a freaking great time to not be dieting. Doesn't mean that you have to stop, but it's a great time not to be. But it's like, nothing has to change. It's Christmas Day is Christmas Day, and Boxing Day is Boxing Day, or as I learned on another podcast today, Boxing Day is St. Stephen's Day in Ireland. Yeah. Didn't know that. Or Northern Ireland. Anyway, yeah, I think people overthink, and I understand why. It's an anxious time for people, but as you can see, none of us are changing anything.
I think a lot of the pressure that people feel is from themselves. And it's like, once you recognize that all this pressure and all this worry is you're creating it, and actually taking it back a step and going, if I just eat to a good level of fullness and enjoy the foods and see, like, potentially time for a lot of people to spend time with their family, catch up with family and friends, things like that, then there's actually huge amounts to be gained just from being a bit more relaxed about things, rather than feeling that, like you said, that the world needs to turn upside down for a few days because I'm around all this food all the time and, like, I'm going to have all these comments. Just chill a little bit, it'll be fine.
Yeah. I'm trying to think back to, like, when I remember, I don't know if we spoke about this, when I ate a whole box of lint balls one day because I was like, I need to get out of my system, a whole box of lint balls. And I was like, then it's gone. The classic screw it mentality. And this was quite a while ago. And I'm trying to think back to my mentality, what it was then and why I did that. And it wasn't a case of feeling bad at the time then. It was a case of, well, then they won't be here anymore, obviously, and then I won't have to eat it. And so I'm trying to keep that in mind, obviously, because I know that people do have that fear. But it's like, I think that's why unconditional permission to eat is really important. Trusting yourself that you can have a lint ball. And the only reason you can't have a lint in your house is because you have that attitude. If you remove that attitude and say, I just want to enjoy this, then you can have them in your house all the time. But obviously, that's a lot of the work that we do. Okay, Anna, do you have a question?
Yeah, tying in, I suppose, quite nicely with the last question and the time of year, how to cope or deal with unsupportive parents, family, other halves, when you're trying to better yourself or on a fat loss phase and they just don't understand, or are trying to, like, push food on you. And
I like that really seamless link there. That was
no, yeah.
First, I bet. Do you want to start, Lou?
Yeah, I think we spoke about this quite a bit, of just being that compassionate, like, assertive firm, that's not helpful right now. And maybe potentially sitting down. I know one of my clients, I think I might have spoke about this last week, or I spoke about it recently somewhere. One of my clients was quite worried about going for food at her sister's, and they go there once a week. And she's dieting at the moment, and they've both got a history of strange relationship with food and or poor relationship with food and dieting and sort of at home as well. I think that stems from that. And she was second guessing everything that her sister was saying and was almost giving into sort of the sabotage mentality. And I was just like, have you sat down and sort of discussed this with her and had an open conversation? Like, have you thought about it? And she's like, not really, no. And then, because the people around us, the people who care for us, want the best for us. And if you phrase it in a way, like Amelia was saying on a story earlier, of how to use your language, to get people to support you and help you. If you say, if you could help me and support me, it would really mean a lot to me right now. Like, it isn't helpful when you keep asking me if I'm full. Like, I know when I'm full, and I just want to do my best, and I'd really appreciate it if you could support me right now. And a lot of the time people go, I didn't even realize that I was doing that, or I didn't realize it was affecting you that way. What can I do to help you? And having that open line of communication can be super beneficial in these points, because I think a lot of the time we're second guessing people and they're second guessing us and our actions, when if we're all just a bit more upfront and honest, going, this is my goal at the moment, I'm actually trying to diet, and people forcing stuff, like, if I don't have more than one of dessert or more than one chocolate, it's not because I'm not being offensive, it's just because I've had enough. And I think feeling comfortable and confident enough is a difficult thing, and most of the time I think it'll be okay. And most people that I've sort of recommend this to or spoke to about, they've sort of had a good supporting environment. And if not, then at least you've put your stall out and made them aware of what you want, and that's where you can go, I've already spoke to you about this, it's like, this isn't like, and have that assertive nature then.
Yeah, I think you're obviously completely right, and I think that there was two things that I was going to say there. The first, I think we spoke about before, have I said about my mum's Madeleine look? Have I told you this before? Yeah. Like, so we, like, my family have got similar strains or have had similar strains with sisters and mum, etc., around food. And we had that open time of discussion. And now my mum has, like, we call my mum's face after dinner the Madeleine face, which is like the little French cakes that you get, that because when we used to eat them on the beach, they'd be covered in sand, and she'd be like, have another cake, and she'd pull this face, and it's like, I don't want another cake, mum, but I'm five, so I'm just gonna take it. So now when she does it after dinner, she's like, there's some more, who wants some more? And it's like, mom, you're doing the Madeleine face again. And she's like, oh, sorry. And then it's fine, because we've had that open discussion, so don't assume that they will shoot you down. The other thing is that, are they genuinely trying to sabotage you? Do they genuinely not understand? Or, again, coming back to what I was saying earlier, or is this what you're telling yourself because you judge them? Often we perceive people to judge us on things that we judge other people for. So are you actually sat at the table thinking, well, my sister's not eating that? And has that happened in the past where if you've both had strained relationships with food before, have you been competitive with her in the past about what she's got on her plate or judged what she's got on her plate? Because the chances are, if you've done that or you continue to do that to her, then she might not even be doing it to you. And these other people might not even be doing it to you. It's just that you perceive them to be doing that because that's what you do to other people. And it's the same as like people, like if we take it on a kind of broader scale, people who judge people for their bodies, or you know, we look at people and we make comparisons of their bodies, and it's like you automatically assume that people are doing that to you as well. Like, I can guarantee you right now, I could diet from a holiday or not diet from a holiday, I would say out of 50,000 people that follow me, one or two people might notice that I'd gained 2 kilos out of that many people. And it's like, nobody else notices, and I know that nobody else notices and cares because I don't notice or care about anyone else. So often we project our thoughts onto other people when actually that's not even happening. It's just our own kind of feelings of, like Anna was talking about last week, of not feeling enough. So we almost just create these things in our heads. Like, if we've stopped being judgmental and we stop comparing, funnily enough, the amount of times that people judge us and compare us drastically goes down. And that's not to say that this is not happening. I imagine there is some sort of narrative there with the family that does need to be talked about. But a question to the extent of that, potentially something to consider is, well, is it because actually I'm sat at the table judging what they've got on their plate?
Yeah, I think if you can have that chat so that they can be more supportive, equally, even if the chat turns into more of a kind of boundaries and you don't make comment about food, we don't talk about what I'm doing, then that can also be quite helpful.
Yeah, totally. And that's another really good point. Like, why should people understand? And in an ideal world, right, we would all support each other's goals, right, and understand each other's goals. But why should they understand? I don't know what who this person is, but then I think, well, if your family know that you've maybe had a poor relationship with food in the past, and they really care about you and they really love you, maybe they don't support you dieting, and that's okay because they love you so much, and actually they're scared that they don't know you're working with someone like Louis who's going to manage all this and support you. But they've come in from a place of, we know what's happened before and we're worried for you. And that's okay. They're allowed to feel that way. It's coming from a place of love. Like, they don't have to understand your choices. And like Anna said, you can just say that, okay, I understand. I appreciate why this is. And you don't need to understand, but my boundary is this. And this is the only way that we can have a civil, lovely family time. That's all I've got to say on that. Okay, questions. I've gone so far down. Okay, totally off topic again. This is great. We'd love to know your thoughts on weight loss, nutrition, education when it comes to teenagers and children. I remember feeling fat from the age of 7, and I also know when I did want to lose some weight as a teenager, I didn't really know how. We had to weigh ourselves in the classroom, which I think is a horrendous idea. Preach. Especially when you aren't told all of the information you are, like BMIs, etc. Do you think it's a good idea to educate about calories at this age, or does it lead to problems later down the line? I'm really interested to know what you all think. Louis, do you want to start on this?
So, I don't think I've formed my full opinion on this, and I haven't got a strong standpoint on it. Because a lot during my master's, a lot of the research was on sort of childhood interventions and things like that with nutrition. And I think it's a very complex issue. A lot of it will be systemic from the top down, parents talking about weight, talking about, I think if we got children on a scale and they didn't know about, like we didn't label it as they're in this category and just use it as data and just feedback, then that I think deep down there is a potential way that this could work. But as a society as a whole, we've got an issue with scales. We've got an issue with labeling people. We've got a lot of weight stigma around. And I don't think we're too far gone potentially to bring it back in the next few years. Children's health is really important. I can't remember the statistics off the top of my head around obese children becoming obese adults. And we know there's issues with BMI and like how it's used and how it's interpreted. However, in an inactive individual, being at a higher weight does have potential risks. In an active individual, it becomes a bit more skewed. The data is not really as reliable. But I don't think talking about calories at a young age is helpful. I think talking about nourishment would be really important and making food interesting. I don't know about you two, but my food tech classes were awful. And I didn't really do anything useful. I don't remember having any nutrition education around nourishing yourself and having a good relationship with food. But as well, with a lot of interventions that I've looked at, there's not strong evidence of them working anyway of improving eating habits in children, because at home, obviously they go home and parents might not have the best nutrition education. And then those potential bad habits are going to be reinforced there and you can't undo them. So it has to be a two-pronged approach. So I think there's a lot going on. There's a lot to unpack, and I don't think there's an easy answer. I do think that we need to take the focus away from calories for kids, because they're growing at different rates. Weight gain is not a bad thing. We should encourage them to have healthy habits, not have numbers involved with it. So let's have a look at eating fruits and vegetables. Encouraging people to be more active and get involved in more sport and the social elements involved, rather than going, let's put them in this category and state that they need to go on a diet at 14 years old, because we know a lot of the people that we have worked with, that the dieting mentality or the implementation or the environment that they grew up has had a huge impact on where they are now, potentially with a poorer relationship with food.
Yeah, can you imagine getting a kid who's overweight and weighing them in front of all of their class, telling them that they're too heavy, then sending them home to their parents who potentially can't afford to feed them in a different way, and that kid then having to come into school, getting picked on for their weight, and then having to go back home and not being able to do anything about it, and then they're then straining the relationship with their parents because they know that they're getting bullied because of the weight and they can't afford to do anything about it. Like, it's just completely toxic. It's so and so disruptive, especially in certain like socioeconomic groups. I think talking about calories, like you said, I think it's to a base level, everyone should be educated in food nutrition, right? Baseline level. But in that situation, no, it should be focusing on, this is what a fruit and vegetable is. Let's go through all the vegetables and see if you can include these in your diet. What does weight matter in the sense of what is weighing someone, especially in the classroom, what's that doing? Like, you can tell visibly, usually, if someone is moving towards a higher, quote, BMI, like, you know, we've got, there's issues with that, but it's helpful on a population level. You can tell that the weighing them isn't helpful. So I don't think we should be talking about scale weights or calories in children. I really don't. And I would certainly, if I have kids one day, I will be excluding them from all of those things at school, like weights and stuff. I will not let them do it, because I think that's really toxic. And the more diets that people go on, the more likely they actually are to have a higher BMI later in life. So actually, if you've got kids starting diets at 10 years old, you're not doing them any favors for their body weight, let alone their health and their relationship with food. It's just I think that's changing, and I like to think that it's changing. So although the class client is young, so it wasn't that long ago.
I think sorry butting in, but they are, especially at that age when they're it's what you say can make such a big impact on it. I think it was, I remember telling Louis, I was in Starbucks and the mum telling the, there was, I think one was a daughter, one was a daughter's friend, and no, you can't have that, that's going to make you fat. I was like, Jesus, no, you don't say, like, they must have been, like, early teens.
Oh, God. And I think, like, we're a lot more educated on it, right? So we know now more so than we did even 5 years ago. So we can bring our kids up in a much more food-neutral environment. And it's very tough for parents. And obviously, I work with a lot of mums, and I'm sure you guys do, and I just think, God, you're bloody heroes, like, how you navigate it. And the work that we do then trickles down, but I think more of that needs to be done.
Yeah.
One of my clients, actually, I think you've mentioned it in posts, Amelia, about how, and it was a realisation she'd had, how with her own child, she'd said, no, you've already had a biscuit, let's have some fruit or something. She's like, I need to translate that to myself now as well. Like, I can do it for him because that's the best for his health, and now I need to do it for me.
I like that.
Yeah, I think, like, as well, in the, I remember teachers passing comments, and I still remember them at school, not particularly about me, even though I was a bigger child, but a teacher quoting to us, I think it was probably about year eight, year nine, a moment on the lips, a lifetime on the hips, and things like that. And she was a lot older, so she, in her generation, I think that's one of the issues as well, is that we have role models that are around very impressionable young kids, and we need to ensure that all role models are being very aware of the words that they're using, and being like teacher, PE teachers and things like that, being inclusive and not using judgmental terms, and encouraging people to undertake healthy habits regardless of what weight size they're at, and actually, instead of making them feel left out, include them and talk to them as an individual rather than sort of putting them to the side and going, well, you're not going to be in the football team because you're too big or anything like that, which is, I've seen happen as a kid, and comments have been passed from teachers to students about students, and I can only, like, those sort of things stick with you. So, like that, like Anna's client said then, like, the words that we use are very powerful around children. They're very impressionable, and they will remember them, and they will copy what parents do. So being aware of the words you use, the actions that you have in front of your children, is really important.
Right. Yes. Next question, Louis.
Oh, give me a sec. So, after dieting, how do you go about going back to maintenance? This was a client who just was curious about the numbers involved and how often, as well as how often you should be adjusting your calorie deficit and things like that. So, Amelia?
Yeah, I would say a couple of things. One, I did a very detailed post on this on Instagram the other day, so definitely look at that for further reference. I think people overcomplicate it in the sense of, you come back to maintenance, your protein will probably stay roughly the same. Come back up to your new maintenance calories, and you can use an online calculator for that, or if you're working with one of us, we will certainly be doing that for you. And then that's really it. You bring your cardio down, and then that's kind of it. Like, there's good strategies you can put in place in the sense of, when you first come out of a diet, try and keep your food sources the same, but increase your food volume, because that will help you feel more satiated, because your hunger will be off when you stop dieting. Your leptin levels are low, which comes when you, because it's released through adipose tissue, body fat. So your hunger levels are probably higher, you're used to ignoring your hunger. So then when you come back to maintenance, you're kind of, you've stopped dieting, you are hungrier, right? So keep your food sources relatively similar, but just increase the amount of them. Taper down your cardio, and someone's asked me this on Instagram today, actually haven't answered, but the reason that we taper down cardio is because when you've been dieting for a while, you do get slight metabolic adaptation, which means that you are expending slightly less calories than you would be had you not dieted at that same body weight. Right, so we want to bring cardio down quite, not slowly, but we want to taper it down. And in terms of like managing that, if you are maintaining weight at your new maintenance calories, then bring your cardio down even more, or give yourself more food, and or bring yourself more food. If you are gaining weight at those maintenance calories, then just keep them there. You're going to gain weight initially. You're going to gain probably 2 or 3 kilos, which is not fat. It's just post-diet water, glycogen storage, etc. That's totally normal. So once that's kind of like you've kind of got to that point, 2 or 3 kilos maybe over, then sit there if you're gaining still. Then maybe your maintenance calories are a little bit too high, but there's nothing wrong with gaining still, especially if you're trying to gain muscle. Your weight should be going up slowly. But I think that the biggest issue that we see is people who are too scared to go back to maintenance. So they do it, they prolong their diet and they go to like sub-maintenance, but they're still really hungry because they've got what we call diet-induced hyperphagia, which is like excessive hunger. So they're still technically dieting, but they've got no goal and they're trying to stick to these low macros, but because they don't have a goal, they struggle. Then they go over their macros and then they go way over the macros because they feel guilty. Then they go back to restricting again and then they follow this in and out cycle, which is basically like a restriction overeat cycle. So just bring, I know it's taxing. It can be mentally like, oh my God, I don't want to go back to maintenance. This feels like a lot of food, but it's only like, it's still maintenance. You're not going to gain muscle. You're not going to gain fat by being at maintenance. Do you guys have anything to add on that?
No.
Okay. Anna, next question.
Where are we? Okay, so kind of, I'm doing quite well in like following on nicely. When in off season and putting weight back on, what is on average a good amount of weight to put on a week? Or just in general, maybe, because weekly might be a bit.
It depends on, I mean, okay, say you've got someone who is into their off season, right? I'm not talking about immediately post show, right? I'm just talking like into their off season, and you've got a well-trained female, the max amount of muscle she's probably going to gain a month, the max is probably about 1/4 of a kilo, I'd say, if they're well-trained. I don't have the specific numbers, but it's roughly 1/4 of a kilo a month. So that works out at a maximum of 1 kilo every 4 months, which is a maximum of 3 kilos a year, max. Thanks, I'm quite proud of that math. And you can see the cogs turning in my head. But that is if you are in a surplus, that you are consistently hitting your protein targets, you are consistently training, progressively overloading, recovering, sleeping, all of those things, then that's probably going to be about that much. That being said, that's the muscle. In order to be in enough of a surplus for that to happen, you will also have to gain fat alongside that, just because you have to be in a surplus. So by definition, you are going to get some fat gain on top of that. So a max of 4 kilos of muscle, potentially another 4 kilos of fat on top of that, potentially. So that's about 8 kilos. Then you've got the initial couple of kilos that you gain post-show of water, carbs, etc. So that's about 10 kilos. And when I've worked with, well, when I competed myself, actually, I was probably about 10 kilos. So that works out quite well, probably give or take-ish. And everyone's different, because obviously 10 kilos to somebody who is my height is very different to 10 kilos to somebody who's 5'5" and 5'7". So that's all relative. But that would be my answer. She says sheepishly. Blue, do you have anything else on that?
Yeah, like Amelia's just hit the nail on the head there. There's not much to add to that. I think from the research, Amelia can, or Anna can correct me on this, the surplus that you need is probably like 120 calories, is it? Or something like that?
Yeah, I think it's like average. Like I normally go with like 200-ish.
Yeah. And but like the actual, so it's tiny and it's probably unrecognizable and you wouldn't be able to accurately hit that. So going into that sort of 200 250 calorie surplus and just embracing a bit of increase in body fat, and it will probably distribute quite well because you're doing it quite slowly, plus you'll have muscle mass underneath it and you'll probably feel like really strong and enjoy the off season. And then yeah, it's about not being afraid of upping your calories and seeing the scale go up during the off season, because it's the best time to grow, and it's a long process. You're probably really excited to probably eat more food and gain a bit of weight initially, but it's a bit of a grind as well. It's a very slow process, muscle gain. So if people, you see, if you see anybody talking about like rapid muscle gain or anything like that, the amount that you're gaining is quite minimal. So ensuring that you're controlling the amount of body fat you're gaining and minimizing that, because at the end of the day, if you are going to compete again, you'll have to take it back off at the end of it.
Yeah, I was having this discussion with someone who's not competing, but somebody who wants to gain, like who's changing their body composition. And the same principles apply. Like, this is where people need coaches, and this is where people, you see them spinning their wheels. They go 2 months into a, they go 2 months at maintenance or a tiny surplus, and they gain a few kilos, and then they go back into dieting for 2 months. And then they do the same again for 2 months and back off for 2 months. And it's like, that's what, you never have sufficient time to gain any muscle, to recover, to sleep, to progressively overload. And then because you diet, then you diet and you don't really look any different because you haven't gained the muscle. You've gained a bit of fat, but 2 months is not long enough to get maybe all of it off. And then you're just constantly in the cycle. Like most people, and I don't have a lot of clients that do this who are not competitors, most people would benefit usually if they're in a, like an average, not an average body composition, but somebody who's like sitting at kind of a BMI range between normal and healthy and overweight, say, most people would benefit from a year of eating in a surplus, maintenance or surplus of solid training before dieting. And not everyone wants to do that, but obviously that's not, like, I'm not even talking about competing. I think that people underestimate just how long that it takes to do it.
Yeah. You see plenty of girls take a full year out and come back being a lot better for it.
So much, yeah.
Yeah, that, I was going to say, like, it's important. I've seen a lot of natural bodybuilders take a year or two off because they're like, I'm not at that level yet, or to get to the next level, I know where I need to be. And naturally, it's going to take a long time to get there, and it is a hard graft. So you also hear of a lot of bodybuilders just getting a coach for their diet or their prep, and then afterwards they go, well, I can do my off season. Actually, that's going to ensuring that you've got some support in there for your off season and making sure it's structured and you are progressing, you are slowly gaining weight and you are checking in and things like that. It's just going to make it so much more worthwhile that it's actually worthwhile when you diet next year, because then you're not looking the same.
When I competed, I remember I'd qualified. It was when I came, it was my last show, I came second in the finals and I'd qualified to compete internationally. And the first international show was like three months or something after finals, maybe 4 months. And I remember speaking to someone at the federation, and then I was like, realistically, like, do you think I'll be good for the international show? And he was like, yeah, you just need to gain a couple of, come in and gain a couple of kilos of muscle before that. And I was like, I realize I'm a natural athlete, that will take me 3 years. I was like, and then I filled out and never competed again after that, because I was like, I cannot physically do that. But yeah, it's funny. Okay, let's see. What have I just done here? Oh yeah, okay. What is your opinion on what's more influential in gaining your period back? Eating enough or reducing exercise? I know both are required, but we'd be interested to hear what you think would be most impactful. And this actually falls in line with it. She says that she gets twitching legs when she tries to fall asleep, and she can't control it. Is this normal in recovery? And it, what's really interesting, remember we spoke about this before, because
pins and needles, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And estrogen and
yeah. We've spoken about it on a podcast before, but this person wasn't a client then. But yeah, fluctuating estrogen levels impacts, can give you things like pins and needles, because it impacts your central nervous system. So this kind of restless leg kicking out twitching thing will be related to these fluctuations. Well, not just fluctuations in hormone, but your low levels of estrogen. So it is a sign that your estrogen levels are low. And also it can be a sign of anemia. Like restless leg syndrome is a lesser known sign of anemia. So it's something else to be mindful of. So that's that part of the question. Do any of you have an opinion on that, the first part of that question?
I am more inclined to go for food. I think, well, we've both spoken about keeping training in and reducing intensity. And I think that that is important. But I think a lot of the time, if you've lost your period, it's 9 times out of 10 because of dieting and being scared of eating more.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, I agree. I think you need to have a certain energy availability, and that comes from your nutrition. Exercise is not helping you because it's expending energy, but that's okay if you're eating enough. When it's really not, when exercise could be more impactful than nutrition, I think, is when it's excessive or when it's stress inducing. Like then that is not only causing you to have a low energy availability, but it's also causing physical stress on your body. And if you can't, if you're struggling to also reduce that, that can be a psychological stress, and that's another stress on your body that impacts your period. So I agree with you, Anna. Like, it's ultimately nutrition is the most important, and ensure that you're eating enough. It's definitely not like it's definitely not one or the other. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not as simple as that. Okay. Hold on the rest of that question is, are there any tips to stop the pins and needles and restless leg? But realistically, no, other than get your blood tested for anemia and get your period back for your estrogen levels, which is like, that's what's gonna do it. Sorry, good question.
One was around just quite an open question and just open for discussion. Ketogenic diets, why? That was it. They've heard a lot about it and they don't see what they want to know what the big fuss is, or if there is a big fuss that needs to be made out of it. So what are your thoughts, Amelia?
Okay, why? If you have epilepsy, or if you really love fatty foods and don't like carbohydrates. That's basically the only reasons. High fat diets potentially, so ketogenic diets is high fat, moderate protein, low carb. And it might, for some people that eat a high fat diet, they find that the high fat intake is more satiating. So it's better for their regulating their hunger. And also, I'll tell you why in a minute, but my best friend is keto and she finds it massively reduces her cravings. So that's very, very individual. But if you look at the research, ketogenic versus low carb versus high carb, when all calories are matched, it makes no difference at all to fat loss. So in terms of fat loss, it doesn't matter. But if you personally find it's helpful for your appetite, fine. The issue is that people think that it has some sort of superior benefits to their health. It doesn't. They struggle to then socialize because they can't eat the ketogenic diet when they go out for dinner. Then they eat carbs and then they feel like they fucked it. So then they just spend a week binge eating because they've messed up their keto diet, when really they could have just eaten and carried on like normal. My best friend has fibromyalgia and she gets really bad brain fog. And anecdotally for her, she's really found the ketogenic diet has supported her. There's no evidence at this point at all for that. In science, it's just an interesting observation that she's followed for 4 or 5 years and she's really noticed it for herself. But yeah, the research is there for children in epilepsy that it could potentially help manage seizures.
Yeah, I've had one client that's found higher fat diets helped her migraines, but other than that, that's been the only positive that I would know. I think personal preference, whether you're dieting or not, if you prefer higher fats, if they're more satiating, if you enjoy them, go do it. Good for you. But I like carbs. Sorry.
Yeah.
It's, when I've done keto in the past, I've found it that you just don't enjoy food. So you don't eat. As bad as that sounds, and that in that way, it's a really effective way to diet, because you just don't look for you if you're eating mainly meats or things that are just nuts and stuff like that. The taste, eventually, you're a bit like, I could definitely leave that. I'm not bothered, and that can really help you in general. There's no, like Amelia said, there's no benefit into actual fat loss, but if it helps you become more adherent and keeping a very low calorie diet, then that's another way that it could be effective. But that's just personal experience that I just, but I found that I probably moved less. I was miserable, more miserable. And yeah, it's so socially isolating for most people, because the nice foods that we tend to enjoy and share usually tend to be higher in carbohydrates. So it sort of makes you a bit more isolated in those incidences.
Yep. Right. Shall we do, Anna, do you want to get a question and I'll do a question and then I think we will do the other ones after.
Where are we? tips for food cravings. This could be quite a short, short answer. Louise.
See if it is a craving or whether it is actually hunger. So it's sitting back and going, what is my intent with this? Is it to have actually like resolve my hunger, or is it that I'm hiding something or I'm looking to numb something? Often with my clients that it's, they come to us and they're like, well, I can't have this food in the house, and they crave it, and they either have an all or nothing relationship with it. And developing that middle ground mindset with it, where there's a common approach I've heard where it's basically like, have it every day if you can. If you can fit it into your calories, have it every day, to a point where you go, oh, I don't really want that. And that's where you're in a really good point with that food, where you're acknowledging, I've had it every day. It's, you take away the power from that food a little bit. So that's a good thing, that if you can, if you are tracking or if you're mindful eating, just trying to have a little bit each day can take the edge off and actually get you to a point where you go, oh, I can take or leave it. And that's a good place to be. And that's where you've sort of got to a good place.
I like that. I think have it. Have a bit of it and enjoy it mindfully is one way. The other thing you can do is what we most of us, some of our clients will have done, is the surfing the urge, where you notice the craving and rather than distracting yourself or eating something else, just sit with it. And the average time for a craving to dissipate is roughly half an hour. But you don't just sit and just watch TV. You actually sit and you say, right, where do I notice this craving? What does this feel like? Do I feel like tingly fingers, or do I feel like a growling in my stomach, or is it my heart racing? And sitting with it actually helps you identify if it's a genuine want for that food. And if you still want it after half an hour, then go wild. Don't go wild, eat it mindfully. But if you don't, then it might just be something else. It might be like you might be feeling anxious, and actually you've got this habit of every time you feel anxious, you go and you want a specific food. So it depends on where you're at with your journey and what works for you. But I think both of those options can be really helpful.
I always tell my clients about setting. I used to have a Freddo a day, similar to Louie's idea, just because it's something small. Even though they're extortionately priced now.
how much do they cost now?
Like, I want to say 30p, 25p. I know.
Oh, God, a 10p Freddo was just a delight, wasn't it? but yeah. Okay, last question, and it's a totally different question again. And I would like your personal opinions on this. Any advice on how to let go of a relationship with someone who you're still in love with and they don't seem to care? I feel really crap and I'm left I feel really crap, like she's just left and doesn't care. How would you deal with it personally? Just a brief answer is sufficient.
I'd acknowledge that you're mourning something. That you're mourning the loss of something, and that's totally normal, and your feelings are valid, and process them and find your own way of sort of grieving that, and however you might want to do that in a way that suits you. But also taking a bit of a rational perspective on it, when I've had breakups before, differences in when am I most recent, which was a couple of years ago, she broke up with me, and then after a while, once I'd got past the sort of grieving and mourning stage, you realize that, oh, I'm worthy of being with someone who loves me, and if they don't love me, then why am I wanting to go back to them? I'm worth more than that. So once you get to that stage and realizing your worth and your value, work on yourself. And I don't mean that you're not good enough now. I mean, work on yourself as in do things that you want to do and rediscover who you are as a person. That can be a really, really enlightening and great journey to go on, because then you're ready. If you do want to have another relationship in the future, then you know what you really want, what you value, and you will get the most out of that relationship and they'll get the most out of you as a partner.
Do you know what? That made me quite emotional. Like, I was like, oh my God, I'm actually starting to sweat over here. I think the grief thing is really important. Like, you've lost something and you have to sit with that grief, and grief is horrible, but it's transient and it will pass. And unlike the grief of potentially like losing somebody, like somebody dying, for example, like that grief can stay with you forever, but you learn to live with it. I can guarantee that this grief of this relationship will not stay with you forever. This is a transient grief and it will pass. And like Louis said, in months to come, you'll be like, oh my God, I'm better than that. And you really are better than that. And it's, heartbreak is the worst thing, is potentially one of the worst things in the world. And I say that in 2020, like, it's horrible and we've all been through it. And it's an ego dent, right? When someone says they don't want you, it literally, it's like a stab to your ego. And, you know, we try not to have egos, but let's be honest, we all do. And it's like you immediately go back to that narrative of I'm not good enough. And then it's like it confirms all of your beliefs of never being good enough. And it's just, God, it makes me feel sick just thinking about it. Heartache's horrible, but you do get through it. And I think objectively and rationally, remove aspects of them from your vicinity. Remove their social medias. Like, I have ex-boyfriends on mute now who I love, who I have good relationships with, but I don't want to see their shit. Like, it doesn't help me. So even that, so mute them, delete them, remove their stuff from your visible eye line. It's all been really, really helpful. And just like what you said, work, like, focus on yourself, focus on what you can do at the moment. I just know that it'll pass, and it just makes me feel sad because it's so, I hate heartbreak so much. Do you have anything to add, Anna?
No, just listen to Lizzo, that she sorts it out.
this client is a man, so you might not like Lizzo so much. Although,
I think. No, they're all women that I've listened to, I'm afraid.
So, two things. Amelia kindly sent me a book and it has been phenomenal so far, and I've had so many realizations, and there is bits on here how to grow out of these experiences, and it's called I Used to Be a Miserable Fuck by John Kim, and it's phenomenally, it's very dry, it's very blunt. And just also, as a sort of fellow male, I was just a bit like, this, I genuinely mean this, this will be the best thing that ever happens to you. Take it on that note, and you will grow from this, and you'll look back and go, I learned so much from this experience, and you'll be better for it. So I know it sucks right now, and it will suck, and it's meant to suck, but after that, it will be the best thing that happens to you.
Agreed. And on that note, I'm going to go and have a cry. Why am I such an emotional wreck? It's not even my luteal phase. Thanks everyone for your questions, and as always, we've got plenty more to work through, so we are, but keep them coming because we love the variety of questions also. They are excellent. Thank you everyone. Thank you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.